Hello and welcome to The Loop, where we untangle today's business issues by throwing real-life scenarios at RSM experts to deliver practical advice on how middle-market companies tackle current business issues. In this edition, we're discussing international business expansion and the potential issues you could face along the way. While growing your company across new regions may seem intimidating and complex, it can also be hugely rewarding and has been described as one of the best decisions you'll ever make with the right advice. With the different risks associated to each foreign market, knowledge is power when it comes to international expansion. So it's just as well that I'm joined by RSM's Head of Transactional Services, Rob Donaldson, and International Tax Specialist, Claire Spencer. Claire, Rob, welcome to you both.
Great to be here.
So first of all, tell me a little bit about yourselves. Claire, I'll come to you first.
Thanks, John. So I'm a tax partner in the Northwest. I have held a number of roles in industry looking after in-house tax for big businesses in the Northwest. I returned back into practice in 2015, and now I help clients expand overseas, existing operations, or to take their first steps overseas as well.
So you're the perfect person to speak to then when it comes to the international implications of tax.
Absolutely.
Rob, how about yourself?
So I'm a corporate finance partner, and for the last 20 years or so, I've been helping clients both sell their businesses or grow through acquisition.
We're here to untangle some practical advice for middle market companies on expanding internationally and to help them to navigate challenges along the way. Now, we're going to do this by throwing real life examples at you both, and we're looking for you to deliver guidance on how to deal with different scenarios. There'll be two scenarios that we'll throw at you. So first and foremost, do you accept the challenge?
Yes.
Can't wait.
You said that like you meant it as well. Fantastic. So here's the first challenge. I own a family-run soft drink maker based in Cambridgeshire. So this is an important story. It's my business. And I have a number of outlets across the UK. I'm based obviously in Cambridgeshire, but I have facilities in the north of England and in Wales as well. It's a successful business. We've been going for a number of years. But we recognise the next stage of growth is through expansion outside of the UK and into Europe. We think Spain could be a positive step for us into one of the markets there. So my challenge to you first is, how should I go about that expansion into Spain? Claire, what are the options open to me? How should I be thinking about it?
Your main couple of options are whether you expand organically, so you go and open your own entity in Spain, or whether you find a target and buy them and take yourself straight into the market. From a compliance and a process perspective, the organic route takes longer. You've not necessarily got the knowledge of the market or the experience, and then you've got your international issues to consider. If you acquire, then you are acquiring a business that is already established in that market. They've all their taxes all set up, all their people are in place, they have the expertise. So if you have the funding in place and or the potential to get the funding in place and you are happy to acquire, that's probably the quickest way to gain traction overseas.
So what advantage is there then in the organic starting from scratch approach that you've suggested?
So starting from scratch is attractive for businesses that have a very strong brand already and may already be exporting. Perhaps if you were already exporting to Spain, there may be a ready-made market for you to take a natural step, establish your own company, deal with all the compliance, which is just processes that you sort out. My view is it's got to be the commercial rationale that drives it. How quickly, how patient, how niche is your business and what you're trying to achieve? And if it's extremely niche, you may struggle to find a target that closely aligns to your business objectives. However, if it's broader and you can find a target that either naturally sits next to your business or is an extension of what you do already, then I'm sure Rob would be able to find you a target in Spain.
Well, let's move on to that, Rob. I'm acquisitive, but I need something to acquire. How do you find the target?
Yeah, I mean, sort of searching for an acquisition across Spain or any European market, I have people who are the equivalent of me in Spain or in Germany or in Italy or in other European markets who do what I do and would help me bring potential targets to you, and then finding the target is one thing, and then actually undertaking the acquisition itself is the next step.
So what happens next? You approach those companies. What's the process there?
Every transaction requires both a willing buyer but also a willing seller. So step one is to really understand whether those targets might have an interest in being acquired.
And would that be part of the consideration in the first place when you're drawing up the list?
It would, although until you actually start the conversation, you never really know for sure. But yes, I mean, you know, we'd be looking for companies where, you know, for example, if there's an aging shareholder base, that might suggest that there's a possibility of a transaction. Or if it's under private equity ownership, there's a reasonable expectation that at some point that business will be sold. We'll be looking for markers that suggest a transaction could be possible. But actually, you never really know until you start.
So we're getting a step closer. We're looking at targets. We've, say, for instance, found a target. Maybe it's a business in Spain. You need to get under the bonnet, though, and see what's there. And that is, of course, a question of due diligence. Claire, what happens in respect of that? What do you need to be thinking of when it comes to due diligence?
When you look at due diligence on an overseas target, the key is to have local advisors, part of a global network, but local advisors, because I'm a UK tax person. I know a bit about Spanish tax, but I don't know enough to undertake full due diligence to understand where the skeletons might be hidden, so that we can pull them out and get everything on the table as part of the transaction. Common things that you see that come back to bite them in terms of tax due diligence would be employment taxes, benefits, directors and the way that they're taxed on their income and all of those kinds of things. Corporate tax normally is relatively straightforward. It's the indirect tax, it's the employment taxes and the other taxes that we don't have in the UK that we rely heavily on those advisors to flag if there's a problem, in addition to the tax due diligence.
How long does that process normally take? Is it a piece of string question, or can you expect to be able to oversee something like this over the period of, I don't know, 6 months, 3 months?
It depends how well prepared the target is and how good their ability to sort of handle a diligence process is. And you know, a business that has been prepared well on the other side of the table, a due diligence process can be done in weeks. On the other hand, if a company is not very well prepared, you're right. I mean, potentially, 6 months would be, a possibility.
Okay, so we're progressing slowly towards this deal. We've identified that we want to acquire. We found a target. We've done some due diligence and basically we're quite happy with what we see. So how do we do the deal? It's a Spanish company we're thinking of. Rob, you first. What are the mechanics there?
Yeah, so the due diligence, as we mentioned, is an important part of that process. You then have to consider, how are you actually going to fund a transaction? So that may be through, some of your existing facilities or cash flow, but you may need to raise some additional debt. You may need to raise equity. And in each case, your advisors are there to help you, come up with the most appropriate funding package. That's not just about price. So yes, you want to minimize the cost of your funding, but you also want to make sure that it's appropriate for the business's requirements as you go forward, so that you're not overburdened with debt and it doesn't sort of dilute your equity any more than is necessary. So part of our job is to come up with the right funding package to help.
And what's the mix that you perhaps see most often? Is it businesses funding through their own reserves or acquiring debt, borrowing money in order to make the acquisition?
Yeah, I mean, in our experience, most businesses, if they can, want to use their own resources and or bank debt, because they do not want to be for their equity to be diluted. And that's understandable. But equally, what you don't want is to end up with a business that is so overburdened with bank debt that you risk the whole edifice coming down. So you need a sensible approach to come up with the right balance of funding. Ever since the financial crisis, there are many other forms of debt financing available. And there is, over £1 trillion of dry powder, as it's called, that's uninvested private equity money that is looking to invest in, UK family businesses who are looking to expand.
How easy is it to harmonise the tax affairs of two different companies, one acquiring the other from two different countries? Is it as difficult as it sounds, or sitting as an expert as you are, can you see that actually is something that can be done relatively easy?
It's relatively easy. There are lots and lots of businesses that have a UK parent and European operations in and non-European operations all over the world, and each one of those will have their own reporting requirements, and you pull the money back to the UK and so on. So it's a well-trodden path. People are already doing it. It's not groundbreaking. So advisors generally know what to do and how to do it. One of the main things to consider is, depending on the size of your group, your enlarged group, once you've completed your acquisition, there are certain triggers, normally around 200 million euros turnover per year, with some other thresholds in there as well, that if you meet them, you have to consider certain other tax reporting.
Okay, we want to do the deal, but what are some of the other implications that need to be considered here?
In terms of the people, probably the most important asset of most businesses, it'll depend on whether you want to retain some or all of the existing management or whether they're going to exit as part of the transaction. If they want to remain, it's very likely that you'll have to incentivise them. So you'd need to consider how that looks. Do they want equity in Topco? Do they want other incentives to be put in place?
So this is already sounding expensive.
It depends on whether you want to keep them or not, I think. Some business owners will want to exit on a transaction like this. Some business owners will want to be part of an enlarged group. And if their objectives are closely aligned with yours, it might be beneficial to have somebody remain involved who has good knowledge of that Spanish market for you. So in terms of people, it's very much about the senior execs. The rest of the employees, you would expect that they're already in a fully functioning company. They will just continue with their jobs day to day, unless you decide to make some fundamental changes post-acquisition.
There's a high risk of failure here, though,
There's a risk of destroying some value in what you've just acquired if you haven't thought through, you know, how are you going to motivate and incentivize the people? How are you going to make sure, you know, an acquisition to be acquired is unsettling for the management and staff of the target. And so you have to think ahead of time about how are you going to keep, the value in what you've acquired by integrating it successfully. You know, the old adage that, you know, failing to prepare is preparing to fail. I think that provided you have thought the process through in advance and you plan accordingly and you get some support.
Thanks, Rob. So overall then, I'm seeing a bit of an optimistic picture about what an acquisition might mean for my business and the route and the way that I go about it. Overall, we would say this acquisition is potentially a good move for my company if we feel that we have the strength of our convictions. So we're going to change things now and look for a different perspective. My family-run business is looking to the future, and we're thinking that maybe a strong option is to become the target of an acquisition. We want to put ourselves up for sale. We're interested in seeing what opportunity there is for a buyer from outside the UK, perhaps the US. How do you go about that? How do we start the process of getting businesses in other countries elsewhere interested in my business?
Well, I mean, you know, the rules of selling a business are the same as the rules of selling anything else, to be honest. The presentation and packaging of what you have to sell is very important. So step one, before you even consider talking to potential buyers, is to, you know, prepare yourself, prepare your business for the due diligence process, but also to package the opportunity to a potentially buyer. You have to tell a story to a buyer or an investor in order for them to get excited about the opportunity and to put an attractive deal to you as a shareholder.
Now, we're thinking about the potential of a US investor coming in here, Claire. From their perspective, is the UK a place that makes sense to invest from a tax perspective? Clearly written laws, a good rule of law, and certainly when it comes to business, the kind of environment they might want to be in.
I think that's right, John. I think our tax system is very well established. It's, despite recent politics, it's relatively stable, even compared to some other European jurisdictions. It's still a safe place to invest. Our tax rate is an attractive one. Our corporate tax rate is attractive. And the US would feel that the UK is a natural extension to what they already do.
And when it comes to tax, what are the issues as relate to the people in my company? What do we need to do to incentivise them to accept a deal and to see that a deal has a future for them too.
OK, yeah, I think that's right, John. In terms of people, you'll have several layers to consider. So you've got your main shareholders, so I expect that'll be your family, that would be selling their interests in your company. If they qualify for entrepreneur relief, you would expect that they'd only pay 10% capital gains tax on those disposal. You'd have to check who qualified and whether everybody would, because that can be quite an emotive subject as well. If there are any existing share schemes within your business for your wider staff, that's a consideration. You'd need to look at their shareholding, what tax they would pay on that disposal. And you would also, I would expect your acquirer, the business looking to buy you, would want to know who was staying out of your key management team. So some of your family may not want an active role in the business. They would probably expect your key management team to remain, and you would be looking to negotiate your position going forward. So you'd consider the disposal, so your exit, and then you would also consider your position going forward.
And this is a key issue, isn't it? You're looking at potentially this US firm buying a UK manufacturer. So you're buying the product, but you're also buying the expertise and the knowledge that runs that firm as well. So there will be a fairly high number of existing managers and senior people in the business that they'll want to keep. How do you incentivize them? How do you get them to stay in what is an unsettling time, a takeover?
There are various ways that you can in terms of equity incentives. So you can give them shares in the newly created group. You can give them other kind of incentives in terms of bonus structures and all of that kind of thing. That one of the biggest issues that we see when a business is acquired by the US is, while it's a natural extension to the US generally, there are some quite fundamental cultural differences between how management teams in the US function and in the UK, which can give some interesting results when we see our clients being acquired. It's a separate country.
So this is being sensitive to the country that you're investing in and understanding it's a very different place.
It's yes. And while the US execs who are acquiring you will be very, very keen to keep you on board, I would expect, I think you need to be prepared, and they need to be prepared for some cultural flexibility in terms of learning to work together and expectations on both sides.
Now, we speak the same language, obviously, in the UK and in the US.
Sort of.
Yes. But with that in mind, does that make the UK an attractive option for US firms? Is this a country where it's easier, frankly, to be an outsider investing in?
Yeah, I think the UK is often seen as a landing page into Europe. And I think whilst that may be threatened a little bit by the uncertainties around Brexit, I think it's still the case that, you know, the UK is a familiar jurisdiction for US inbound investment and an attractive one. You know, we're a very open market. We're open to international M&A, and there are fewer barriers to acquiring here in the UK, both cultural, language and legal, than there might be in other parts of Europe. I think the UK has largely always seen inbound investment as a positive, that, you know, there is, you know, a great deal of expertise that an acquirer can bring into the UK. And, you know, I think we've seen it in the past as a way of enhancing, you know, the efficiency and the productivity of our economy in the UK. There are other European countries that take a different view.
What do you think?
I think to close our minds to inbound investment would be a mistake. I think broadly inbound investment is a force for good. There are always transactions that perhaps you wish hadn't happened or could have been done better.
OK, Rob, thanks for that. Finally, for you both, in respect of both of these scenarios, whether or not my family firm is the acquirer or being acquired, lots to think about. What would your top tips be for a company that's really having a hard think about its future and the type of business it wants to be and where it's going? Your top tips in respect of both of the potential scenarios. Claire, to you first.
Mm-hmm. Selecting your team of advisors is key. You're looking for advisors that have got the right experience. They've done it before. It's not new to them as well as new to you, that you trust them and that you actually like them, because going through a transaction like this or being acquired, you spend an awful lot of time with them, and it's a long time to spend with somebody that you don't like.
So it's a personal thing. It's trusting
well.
The people you're dealing with.
Absolutely, yes. They're going to have to be with you every step of the way and post-transaction as well. The other thing that some tax people are surprised by when we actually look at it is keep an eye on the cash flow. And it sounds relatively basic, but there are certain tax things such as withholding tax and retentions on certain payments that are held within overseas contracts that can kill your cash flow. So while something, a project or a venture, looks profitable in the longer term, the drain on cash can make it prohibitive at certain periods.
So it's that unexpected tax bill that might suddenly hit you.
Yeah, and the timing of the payments is quite important with tax, in terms of it might be profitable overall, but is it going to, if you need 20 million to fund it at key points, have you got that money?
I assume that's something that you would advise on as part of the process. You'd look ahead and say, watch out, in 6 months' time, you'll be liable for this.
Yes, definitely. Both in my roles in industry and as an advisor, we've helped clients model those projects and those expansions out for kind of 2 year periods and further to see what that actually looks like.
Okay, and Rob, for you.
Well, I guess my top tips depends on whether you're buying or selling. So if you're acquiring, I think the first tip would be to make sure you don't get carried away in terms of the price you pay. It's very easy in any competitive environment, any form of auction, which is effectively what you may end up in, to overpay. The second point, if you're acquiring, would be, don't start a war unless you know how you're going to win the peace, by which I mean, you know, acquiring a company is the first step. And the second tip there, if you're selling, is probably, you know, make sure you think carefully about who you actually sell to, because you're going to have to live with the consequences afterwards.
Rob, Claire, it's a fascinating subject, both of those scenarios. Thank you for your time and taking the time to run through some of the pros and cons and pass on a little advice as well as to how to go about it. If you want to find out more information and advice, you can check out RSM's latest campaign, Global Growth, Connecting Your World to Ours, at www.rsmuk.com/globalgrowth. That's /globalgrowth. And we're keen on your views as well, so do rate us and leave a review of The Loop. And to keep in The Loop, please subscribe to The Loop and listen to our next podcast, where we'll untangle today's big business issues.